Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, articles and posts are flying around the web with headlines like, "The End of the Internet." How serious is the threat of the disturbingly named Communications Opportunity Promotion and Enhancement Act, and what can you do about it? And how does that connect to the threat currently facing public access TV? We'll talk about both issues with Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy. Also on the show, when activists used to protest the World Bank and IMF, many in the mainstream media took the lazy way out, basically pointing and laughing at the blue-haired street-marching anarchists. Nowadays, coverage of the World Bank has a new problem, kid-glove treatment of its new boss, former Pentagon official Paul Wolfowitz. He's getting high marks from the press, but what do World Bank critics think? We'll speak to one, Anne-Louise Colgan of the group Africa Action. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
It's hard to watch TV news for very long these days and not see something about soaring gas prices. Not that that something will necessarily be good reporting. Take the April 25th broadcast of ABC's World News Tonight. In one segment, reporter Martha Raddatz mentioned that George W. Bush is, quote, directing the EPA to ease environmental regulations on fuel requirements, close quote, and suggesting a rollback on some oil company tax breaks. As Raddatz explained, quote, "These are measures that Democrats and conservationists have been urging the president to take for a long time," close quote. Really? Environmental groups have been pushing for a rollback of environmental regulations? Viewers that were scratching their heads at that one might have been further confused by another segment that night, one ABC dubbed a reality check on rising prices. But the sources invited to unspin the issue were not exactly a diverse bunch. A former Reagan administration official turned energy industry analyst and an investment analyst. ABC's reporter Betsy Stark sounded skeptical about whether any of the White House's moves would have much impact, but she did think one offered some promise, getting rid of pesky environmental rules. As she put it, quote, "What could impact prices almost immediately is a suspension of environmental regulations. The reality here is that waiving the elaborate rules on summertime blends will likely push supplies up and prices down," close quote. While that would be news to the Bush administration, the Washington Post reported that the White House's top economist doesn't think it'll affect prices at all. It's more about, in the paper's words, quote, "making sure some stations do not run out of gasoline than lowering prices," close quote. ABC can out-White House the White House if they want, but reality check probably isn't the best name for it.
A May 1st Newsweek article about the staff shakeups at the White House included the currently popular notion that George W. Bush's low popularity numbers reflect not so much substantive dissent as the fact that the guy just can't catch a break, even when, in Newsweek's words, things go his way. Their example, the economy. Quote, "For the most part, economists say it's strong, and Bush should be enjoying the credit. Instead, polls show voters believe things are still sluggish, largely because gas prices are so high," close quote. But people aren't confused about the economy, as the magazine suggests, by gas prices or by the war in Iraq, as other outlets have had it, or by anything else. Large numbers of Americans don't think the economy is strong for the simple reason that for them it isn't. Yes, corporate profits are up and rich people are benefiting mightily from tax breaks and other favorable policies. But though corporate journalists can't seem to get it through their heads, this simply does not mean that everyone is doing better. In fact, wages and incomes for average workers are down in recent years. The poverty rate is increasing along with indebtedness. The article was headlined, "Bush Pops His Bubble," but out-of-touch formulations like that invite the question of whether journalists will ever manage to pop their own.
In high-profile sexual assault cases, lawyers sometimes selectively feed information to the media in the hopes of helping their client. The ethics of such tactics are dubious, but they can sway potential jurors or even pressure an accuser into dropping a case due to unwanted publicity. In the Kobe Bryant case, for instance, after a defense lawyer accidentally named the accuser repeatedly in court, the woman endured harassment and even death threats before eventually dropping charges. So when a 27-year-old dancer accused members of the Duke University lacrosse team of sexual assault recently, it should have come as no surprise that stories began leaking out to a press corps that was, to put it mildly, highly receptive. On April 21st, USA Today looked at that phenomenon in a story headlined, "Prosecutors' Defense Trying Their Case in Public." Well, you'd conclude from that headline that both sides were pretty much equally guilty of leaking. And the first few paragraphs would bolster that impression, describing how the lawyers were leaking information, quote, aimed at casting either Duke lacrosse players or their alleged victim in an unfavorable light, close quote. But the actual evidence in the article shows something quite different. There is exactly one instance of prosecutorial leaking, and the rest of the piece documents the fairly aggressive leaking strategy of defense attorneys, releasing DNA tests, photos, receipts, and other records that purport to clear the players of wrongdoing. Once again, then, media seem to be stretching so hard to be balanced that they've sacrificed a more fundamental journalistic goal, accuracy.
With Chinese President Hu Jintao visiting the White House, there were any number of ways media could talk about China. But PBS NewsHour anchor Margaret Warner presented an April 20th panel on U.S.-China relations that included three people who see things through a business lens and one ideological conservative. The panelists were Kenneth Lieberthal, a political science and business administration professor, also Clinton-era National Security Council staffer, John Kasich of the Right Wing Heritage Foundation, Robert Hormats from Goldman Sachs, and Linda Lim, a professor of corporate strategy and international business at the University of Michigan Business School. The segment reduced U.S.-China relations to a discussion of business and economic issues coming strictly from the viewpoint of business and economic elites. So, while the U.S. trade deficit and currency issues were mulled over, no mention was made of the impact of policy on the citizens of either country, say, trade policies that have moved jobs out of the U.S. to cheaper labor markets, and the related issue of labor and human rights conditions in China, one of the world's cheapest labor markets due largely to poor pay and brutal working conditions. But then you can't have that sort of discussion if you don't invite guests who are likely to raise issues relating to human rights, labor, and the effects of economic policy on the general public. The panel was seemingly no fluke. A search of NewsHour transcripts over the last month shows there was no segment that focused on those issues. So it's worth asking yet again where the public interest is addressed on Public Broadcasting's NewsHour.
And finally, on April 23rd, CBS's 60 Minutes aired a tough report on intelligence manipulation by the White House in the run-up to the Iraq War. Viewers heard from a recently retired high-ranking CIA official who blew the whistle on the Bush administration's dishonesty over the so-called intelligence failure with regard to Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. 60 Minutes also reported on the still mysterious Niger forgeries, documents that the White House and British intelligence relied on to claim that Iraq was trying to import yellowcake uranium from the African nation. But wait a second, that last part might sound familiar. In fact, that story was supposed to air on CBS in the fall of 2004. What happened? Well, it was a case of bad timing. As a CBS spokesperson told the New York Times, quote, "It would be inappropriate to air the report so close to the presidential election," close quote. Translation, it would have made Bush look bad at the moment some citizens could have been deciding who to vote for in November. As Fair noted at the time, few media outlets took notice of this outrageous act of politically motivated censorship, nor did they connect the dots between that decision and the fact that at the very same time, the head of the CBS parent company Viacom was expressing his preference for having George W. Bush in the White House for another 4 years. But at least one question remains. Why is CBS comfortable with airing this story now? Perhaps the growing unpopularity of the war and the the White House makes it safer to report on such unpleasant facts. And perhaps no one at CBS even asks themselves what would have happened if they had aired the segment in 2004, back when it would have really mattered.
Thank you, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. As critics who complain about the anti-democratic, exclusionary nature of corporate media, we at Counterspin often hear the question, but what about the internet? Isn't it inherently a challenge to big media, a technological way to subvert their top-down bias? Experience suggests the answer is not without a fight. This isn't the first time a new media form has invited such hopes. Time was cable TV promised to be a community medium, with localism, low cost, and diversity as central tenets. In both instances, powerful corporate interests have battled with citizen activists and public interest groups over the shape and the purpose of the new media, with, sad to say, corporate interests generally winning the day. As we speak, both the internet as we know it and community TV face serious threats in Congress. On the one hand, telephone companies moving into the business of providing internet and video services are looking to rewrite the franchise agreements cable companies have traditionally made with local communities. On the other, telephone and cable companies are pushing to fundamentally change the way the internet works, charging fees for use and giving preferred treatment to content providers with deeper pockets. Here to discuss these issues is Jeff Chester, Executive Director of the Center for Digital Democracy. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jeff Chester.
Thank you.
Well, clearly these issues are related, but we're going to separate them for clarity's sake and talk first about the future of community or public access TV and this Barton Rush bill. What is at stake here?
Well, the phone lobby, AT&T, which used to be SBC, and Verizon and their supporters are about to wreck community TV. They are using their clout to get the Congress over the next few weeks, unless we can defeat this bill, to eliminate the right of local communities to determine how cable television and indeed all broadband communication systems serve them. The phone companies don't want to negotiate with cities. They don't want to have to have a government agency, a local government authority, overseeing what they do, whether or not they treat everyone fairly. For example, the phone industry only really wants to provide these services to the wealthiest parts of town. AT&T and Verizon want to redline. They don't want to serve low or lower middle income households. They want to pump out tremendous profits that they believe they can garner from selling affluent consumers interactive media and video on demand services. So the phone industry has gone to Congress and has gone to state legislatures and is on the eve of getting Congress to, as I said, eliminate the right of cities to negotiate how the terms of cable service can be accomplished in the community.
Well, one of the things that has come out of the negotiations that cable companies make with local communities is, of course, public access television, those channels we're familiar with. Now, is this bill going to eliminate those public access channels? What's going on there?
Well, what this bill does is it eliminates the right of local communities, local governments and counties to negotiate with cable or phone companies when they either operate or want to operate cable service. I mean, it's very important to remember it's not just plain old cable anymore, that whatever wire passes through your streets, whether it's the phone or cable wire, is going to be delivering you multi-channel television, cable television. It's going to be delivering you voice services, telephone services, and also data services, access to the internet. So there's much more at stake here than just who's your cable provider. Under the Barton Rush legislation, the bill that's now before the House of Representatives, cities would continue to receive fees from companies, so-called franchise fees, and cities would also have access services available, but the access services would be frozen in time. These cities would be given just a few channels at a time when, if we were able to continue franchising, cities could demand and expect to receive from phone and cable companies a significant portion of the capacity of these very powerful wires. Imagine channels and all kinds of services hooking up schools to the internet, serving low-income communities with low-cost or free internet access, advanced systems for public safety. All of those services would be available if the cities had some authority to require the phone and cable giants to pay back the residents of a community, to have a kind of public interest quid pro quo. Sadly, we are about to lose that.
Well, we'll move on now to the other major issue. A recent article of yours in The Nation was headlined "The End of the Internet." I don't know that you chose that, but I'm guessing you don't think it's too much of a stretch. How would the changes that are currently on the table spell the end of the internet as we've come to know it?
Well, my original title actually was "The Hijacking of the Internet."
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what's about to happen. The internet's not going to go away, but its fundamental nature as an open, non-discriminatory, and more democratic medium is under threat. The phone and cable industries have been able to use their clout with the Bush administration to have the Republican Federal Communications Commission change the rules of the internet road. Up until recently, the internet was required by federal rules to be an open medium, to treat all content fairly. Your internet service provider couldn't slow down your email or speed up access to a website if it favored it. Your internet service provider couldn't, for example, cut off your access or slow down your access to a peace website. Well, the phone and cable industry saw an open internet as a real threat to their monopolies over either television in the case of cable, or the phone business in the case of Verizon and AT&T. So the phone and cable lobby went to the FCC, they changed the rules, and now they can determine the internet's digital destiny. They now have the authority to make all kinds of business decisions about how the internet in the United States operates. They plan to speed up the content that they own, and those who can afford to pay to have their content speeded up, they'll get preferential treatment. They could slow up competing content. They could block access to content. What the phone and cable companies want to do is, in their own words, monetize the internet. They want to set up a series of virtual toll booths. If you want your content to come down fast, you're going to have to pay more. If you want to put content online and make sure that content's available to all users, you're going to have to pay them huge fees. So the phone and cable industry's vision, really, for the future of this diverse digital medium is really rooted in cable television. They want to set up a system so that they can extract as much profit as possible, and in particular make sure that the content they own, or that the content backed either by Hollywood and Madison Avenue, is in the fast lane, and everybody else, including, frankly, the public interest, is in the slow digital dirt road.
Well, finally, in the brief amount of time we have left, it seems that industry always skates where the puck is going to be, as I've heard it called. They set up deals that they want, and then they basically help write the laws that make those deals legal. And it's hard to fault the public when we don't really know about what we're losing because we don't even know it's in play. How does the public stand a chance here in rolling back these actions?
Well, not just public interest groups, but some of our biggest new media giants are also alarmed by what the phone and cable industry has planned. So you actually have Microsoft, Yahoo, and Amazon.com, for example, lobbying along with the Save the Internet Coalition. Legislation is about to be introduced in the Senate that would protect the future of the internet, and there are a variety of groups led by a Free Press and Common Cause, among others, that are working on this Save the Internet campaign. So I think right now the public has a real opportunity to get their voices heard, to go to SaveTheInternet.org, to go to MoveOn.org or Common Cause, and send a loud message to Congress that it's our internet and we're not going to let the phone and cable companies do with it as they wish to do.
We've been speaking with Jeff Chester from the Center for Digital Democracy. Find them on the web at democraticmedia.org. Thank you, Jeff Chester, for being with us today on Counterspin.
Thank you.
A few years back, it wasn't hard to figure out what was wrong with media coverage of the World Bank and the IMF. With large street protests against those institutions, lazy reporters could skip the serious critiques and focus on the piercings or the hair color of some of the protesters. These days, the protests are smaller, which means the media spends even less time on any of the issues. What they do seem to find most interesting, however, is the fact that former Pentagon official Paul Wolfowitz is now in charge at the World Bank. And for some reporters, a new media frame has emerged, that of a government official humbled by his Iraq War experience, now determined to fight poverty. Joining us now to talk about this is Anne-Louise Colgan. She's the Director of Policy Analysis and Communications at the group Africa Action. Anne-Louise Colgan, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with a typical framing of this issue. There was a story in the New York Times on April 23rd. It was headlined, "At the World Bank, Wolfowitz Works on Improving His Image." The piece began by noting that at the bank's spring meetings, there was just one small protest. The Times took this as a sign of the, quote, surprising lack of controversy surrounding the 10-month tenure of Paul D. Wolfowitz as president of the World Bank, close quote. The paper added that Wolfowitz, quote, has diffused much of the opposition from advocacy groups, close quote. The article didn't include any advocacy groups who might have critical words for the World Bank or Wolfowitz. So are there any critical things to say about Wolfowitz's tenure so far?
Well, there certainly are. And I think what the media has tended to focus on, as you say, is Wolfowitz's drive to fight corruption in Africa and other developing regions. And for groups like Africa Action, it's really important to point out that this is a very one-sided approach to challenging corruption. What we're seeing from the World Bank is this real desire to hold countries in Africa and elsewhere in the developing world accountable for corruption, but then the World Bank is failing to hold itself accountable for its own internal corruption. And so some examples that we're seeing are the World Bank is talking about now delaying the promise of debt relief for some countries in Africa because of concerns of corruption. And we consider that these debts that we're speaking about are illegitimate debts. They are odious debts, and that debt cancellation is really a matter of justice. And these debts should be written off. And what's important is that the World Bank was also responsible for fostering corruption in some of these countries. And we have many examples of this during the Cold War, but one that especially sticks out is in the case of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Mm-hmm. This country was the recipient of most loans from the World Bank and from rich country governments throughout the 70s and into the 80s. It received more loans than any other country in Africa, than all the other countries combined, in fact, even though it was well known that that government was a corrupt dictatorship and that none of that money was going to benefit the people of that country. So the World Bank must itself be held accountable for corruption in its lending practices, and the debts of African countries must be written off as a matter of justice because it is unjust that they are expected to repay these debts from which the people saw little benefit.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you decide that anti-corruption is going to be your platform, you're bound to get good press out of it, but it does seem like there's been significant public pressure that has forced some of the changes we've seen recently at the World Bank in terms of policy. The problem, I guess, is when you see those kinds of changes reported in the press, it's not about that citizen activism, but it's about kind gestures from the likes of Wolfowitz or other folks at the World Bank. What have citizens been able to accomplish?
Well, absolutely. Corruption is a real concern for civil society in African countries and throughout the Global South. And we've seen in recent years that there are steps being taken on the part of civil society to address this challenge. So we have countries like Uganda that have created a poverty action fund that includes many stakeholders from that country and that ensures that the money freed up as a result of debt relief is used responsibly and is used on social priorities like healthcare and education. And this is an indigenous initiative. It came out of the people of Uganda, and it is something that deserves support. And so this quest for eradication of corruption and this quest for accountability and transparency has to be on both sides. It has to be both on the part of the lender and on the part of the borrower. And what we're seeing instead from Wolfowitz is something that is very one-sided and that targets those countries but accepts no responsibility for the World Bank's own role.
Now, coverage of development and growth in Latin America has changed a bit in the last couple of years, as even the World Bank has come to acknowledge that some of the policies that they've advocated in those countries countries hasn't led to a significant economic benefit for the population in those countries. What about in Africa? Can folks connect the dots between economic situations and stagnation in countries and perhaps bad advice from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund? Is there that connection?
There absolutely is that connection. And what Africa Action has been highlighting most especially has been the connection between World Bank and IMF policies and the devastating HIV/AIDS crisis in Africa, because what we have discovered from our research is that World Bank and IMF policies have actually undermined healthcare in African countries and have also, as you say, exacerbated poverty and underdevelopment and have therefore led to an even greater health crisis than would already have been. And so what we had pointed out in an action that was held outside the IMF last Friday was the extent to which World Bank and IMF policies have really been hazardous to Africa's health and have damaged Africa's most important resource, which is, in fact, her people. And the conditions that continue to be imposed by the World Bank and IMF now hinder African governments' efforts to respond to this crisis. So it really is an ongoing and devastating impact.
Those would probably be the protests that the New York Times saw as evidence that Wolfowitz was doing a good job in the eyes of the activist community. On a somewhat related note, Africa Action, the group that you represent, recently called out the Washington Post for its recent treatment of the AIDS crisis in Africa. What were you responding to that the Post had done?
The Washington Post had issued an article and an editorial earlier this month that were disputing the accuracy of the UN's estimates of how extensive the HIV/AIDS crisis is in Africa. And what these pieces seemed to do was to minimize the severity of the crisis on the continent, and we really felt that they were very misleading, that they might lead people to think that the urgency of the crisis was somehow less than people had originally thought, wherein the reality is that the numbers may be slightly less than what were originally projected, but we're talking about at least 20 million people in Africa that are now living with HIV/AIDS, and at least 12 million children in Africa that have lost one or both parents to this disease. And so these countries are still overwhelmed by a health crisis that is almost unprecedented in magnitude, and we felt that these articles lacked that analysis and tended to undermine the severity of the crisis instead of enlightening people as to the realities on the ground.
The Post seemed to be arguing that the statistics were off by a couple of percentage points. It seems sort of baffling to take this on as an issue. Was it connected to some policy that someone's advocating, cutting funds to AIDS prevention or fighting AIDS in Africa, or was it just out of the blue?
It's unclear as to what motivated it, to be honest. I think that the challenges that were faced in the beginning in reporting on the scale of the HIV/AIDS crisis were largely to be expected. I mean, this was a new disease, mm-hmm. and a lot of these countries do not have very sophisticated reporting systems or capacities. But the revisions, as I said and as you pointed out, are actually quite small, and so they really do not raise any questions as to the seriousness of this crisis. And so we felt that it was irresponsible, in fact, of the Washington Post to have written articles that were framed in this way, and that this kind of scrutiny was actually unwelcome and unhelpful.
We've been speaking with Anne Louise Colgan. She's the Director of Policy Analysis and Communications at the group Africa Action. You can find them online at www.africaaction.org. Anne Louise Colgan, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at FAIR, the Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.